This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
No boring. Also, no Tom Hartman. At least not today. I'm Laura Flanders. Tom, wherever you are, hope you're having just a little bit of fun in addition to educating and inspiring the masses. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom for the next 3 hours. Thank you so much for having me with you, all you folks. We've got quite the show lined up, and I'm going to start with this. You know what happens in the next few weeks is we see governors, mayors, and ultimately the president give their state of the, you know what, city, state, country report, right? I want us to think about that today. Are we letting our obsession or our focus or our excitement, our engagement with the presidential race overshadow the very serious concerns facing our country, our state, our cities? Are we letting our excitement and engagement around the state of the slate, if you will, kind of overshadow the state of our state? And I'll tell you why I'm thinking about this. I mean, clearly the election is exciting. We're going to talk to Hugh Jackson. I told you yesterday he's the editor of, he blogs at Las Vegas Gleaner. He's also an independent journalist covering the Nevada politics in general and the caucus this Saturday in particular. He's, you know, it's clear the Nevada caucus is could be very exciting. There may even be the possibility, it seems to me, of an Edwards surprise. We've been talking, a lot of people in the media all week, about the disarray on the Republican side because a different candidate has won each of the competitions so far. I don't think it's beyond the possibility that John Edwards might take off with the caucus delegates, the majority of delegates from Nevada. He's certainly going to get a good bunch of them. The media may not want you to hear about it, but John Edwards has been pulling neck and neck with the other two front runners in the race in that state. So anyway, it could be exciting. Edwards has a lot of appeal for the union voters who are big and powerful in that state. And endorsements aside, there's a nasty little tussle going on between Obama and Hillary Clinton around gaming, which I don't think is going to work well for either one of them. So there's no question that the election is important, it's exciting, important in the sense that when it comes to the big stuff, there is no question there are sharp differences between the Democrats and the Republicans when it comes to at least the symbolism, the rhetoric, the style, if not always as much of the substance of government as we would like. You know, when it comes to the war, for example, when it comes to foreign policy, you've got top advisor on foreign policy for Rudolph Giuliani on the GOP side, Norman Podhoretz, right-wing hawk maniac, who in the most recent issue of Commentary magazine is saying, don't back up on the military, on military action against Iran. President Bush should take military action against Iran soon, he says. Iran can still be stopped from getting the bomb and even more millions of lives can be saved, but only provided that we summon up the courage to see what is staring us in the face and then act on what we see. He's very clear what act means. And you've got support coming for Podhoretz's agenda from right-wing talk radio all over the country, including Hugh Hewitt, who apparently on his radio show has been urging his audience to read this damn commentary piece over and over and over. So there's no question. A Giuliani-Podhoretz agenda with respect to U.S. power internationally is going to be different from a Clinton-Obama-Edwards type of an agenda, if only because there will be people at the back of the Democrats calling for the Democrats to pause long and careful before they take any military action, and that's the least of it. So there's no question that there are big differences, but look at the headlines. Just check out any newspaper you want to see, and you can see a list of headlines that makes you want to weep. The recession, I don't think there's any avoiding that word at this point. Iran and Iraq, I talked about Iraq, we've got an increase in aerial bombardment as the new strategy for U.S. forces. That's going to be claiming more civilian lives. We're not going to make any more friends in that country. At the level of the domestic picture on that war, we've got veterans coming home with 10 times as making as many 10 times as many claims for assistance resulting from post-traumatic stress disorder as we ever had before. A 10 times increase in PTSD claims among vets. You've had 2,200 suicides among veterans since 2005. You've got, well, we know over 3,500 deaths on the U.S. side. This is posing an immediate health crisis, I would say, for veterans. And we've got on the, you know, constitutional side an executive out of control. The story in today's paper about how the security guards guarding Dick Cheney got the local police into a total mess by claiming that an environmental conservationist and critic of Bush-Cheney policy had assaulted the vice president when he did nothing of the sort. And in fact, those agents changed their report, withdrew their charges after the arrest had been made. So now this poor police department is facing this wrongful arrest suit because Dick Cheney's security guards are out of control. You've got the whole question of wireless, warrantless wiretaps coming up again for debate, and that may come up before the February 5th Super Tuesday primaries and will really put the Democratic contenders in the spotlight. So wherever you look, whether you're talking health care or veterans care or issues that seem small, like one of the ones we're going to talk about, actually about a very small thing, nanotechnology, that could have very large impact. We'll talk about that in the second hour. Issues that seem large or small are all around us. And I guess my question to us is, are we focused on the right things? And as we look at this presidential race, the media, we talked about this yesterday, amp up the personalities, the style, the rhetoric, the slight differences between the candidates. The mass media will give us the personality profile before they'll ever talk about actually what matters, which may be how to make a difference in government, how to actually grapple with these crises. Are we focusing on the right things? In our focus on the slate, are we ignoring the state of our states? Well, I would love to hear from you. I'm at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-AAR0. What's the state of your state? And what kind of skills? We talked yesterday about what style of leadership we might have a preference for. But what kind of skills do you think a president coming in 2009 is really going to have? Again, I think there's a lot to be done between now and next January. But in terms of skills, when we come back, I'll tell you another story from my home life, which will show not only the contradictions in one person's perspective, but will maybe lay out some of the questions before us. 866-303-2270. Are we focusing on the state of the slate over the state of the state? You tell me. And what's the state of your state, where you live? 866-303-2270. If you were giving the speech next week, what would you say?
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, we're back. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Our number is 866-303-2270. Coming up in this hour, we'll talk with Hugh Jackson from the Las Vegas Gleaner about goings-on in Nevada the day before the primary, the caucus there. In hour two, we'll hear about the possible perils of nanotechnology, and you say that a million times. In our hour three, we will hear about a victory in Congress, I think a victory, that is. Congressman Chet Edwards will be here to talk about the actual appropriation that was made this week, finally, to increase resources for veterans care. It all pertains to a question in my mind about what's happening actually in our country while this national presidential race plays out. While the focus on the personalities of the race is kind of like the latest episode of Friends, and it's kind of fun to tune in to the debates every few days, it's sort of the national serial that's absorbing us all these days. It's nonetheless true that there are very real problems, from war in the Middle East to increasing violence in Pakistan to recession, there's no way around it, to the crisis of healthcare in this country or foreclosures that require action now by Congress. We'll hear from the congressman how that action actually happens. And we will be thinking about what does governance involve? The challenges that are facing us now, whether they seem small like nanotechnology or large like veterans care, are just a tiny piece of the picture of what any incoming president in 2009 is going to have to deal with. So what kind of skills does that president need? The other day, watching one of the debates, again, I was talking to you yesterday about my partner Elizabeth and I watching these things, and we have different reactions, and if you've been listening carefully, you can see the contradictions in each of our positions. She believes that Hillary Clinton's the best person for the presidency because Hillary Clinton has the ability to get things done in Congress. She knows how to work across the aisle, knows how to get Republican support, knows how to maneuver to a majority on the floor of the Senate. I say, well, but what we need on a president rather than a Senate leader or a House leader is somebody who can articulate some clear agenda items, who can, you know, who can argue forcefully for change. Healthcare. We're not going to get the health insurers to like getting them out of our national healthcare picture. They're just not going to like it. It's not a no-lose situation. There are many situations that are cast to us as a kind of win-lose situation, and they really aren't. There's a way to write to make a compromise. But frankly, around health care, if we're going to get the profit motive out of health care, people are going to lose some profits. Now, my idea is that we need a president who actually has the chutzpah, the guts, whatever the local phrase is where you live, to get the country consensus agreed around some tough changes that have to be made in this nation. And that's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be done by a conciliator. It's going to be done by a persuader and a person with the kind of charisma and courage to take a stand. So that's my question to you. As we look at the slate, let's not forget about the state of the state. How's the state of your state? And what the heck skills do we need to get out of the mess we're in? All right, let's take a call quickly. Let's hear from Barry in Northampton, Mass. Hi, Barry.
I totally agree with what you just said.
Excellent.
But I believe...
Oh, there's a but.
I believe that the forces that govern everything, such as the media, such as the money required for elections, just totally eliminate people of that capacity who do have the forcefulness and integrity to have their convictions and go ahead with them.
And what's your favorite example for that?
Well, Dennis Kucinich, John Edwards. John Edwards manages to get some press, but he gets very little. He gets marginalized all the time. And I expect that were there another debate in a week or 2 weeks, there'd be an attempt to even have him taken off the stage. I believe that the forces such as the media, such as the people behind the money, don't want change and are only going to go and select someone and offer someone who's not going to change.
Well, I don't disagree with you on the way that the media have covered or failed to cover John Edwards, and we've had the total exclusion of Dennis Kucinich, certainly from the most visible fora, which are the national debates. But when it comes to how stuff gets done in Congress, when there is something to be said. I mean, I can hear the argument from people who say, for example, there's a debate right now apparently happening within the peace movement, with some saying, you know what, we tried to get limits on spending, we tried to get time limits on the deployment, we just couldn't get the votes. Let's focus instead on what Hillary Clinton talked about in the debate on Tuesday, which was the how wrong it would be for this president to tie the hands of the next one by committing troops indefinitely or for an extended period to Iraq. That argument makes me crazy, because if you want to solve our recession, if you want to deal with our economic crisis, our healthcare crisis, you've got to deal with how much money we're spending on this war. There's a good report out on this right now from the National Priorities Project. Maybe I'll be able to get to with you later on. But that's the kind of thing where I don't know what I would do. Not exactly. Do you, Barry?
No. Other than... there have been suggestions in in dealing with that and in not putting up spending bills at all.
Yeah. Well, that was my position from the beginning. Let's just have no appropriations bills for the war coming forward. And frankly, that is what I would do.
Yeah,
I think on the war, we need to draw a very clear line. No more spending except to bring the troops home safely. That's the Barbara Lee, Lynn Woolsey initiative. Spend the money only to withdraw the troops. And frankly, it's the closest position. The person who has the closest position to that is John Edwards, who has a pretty accelerated schedule for returning troops, faster than the others, within 10 months, I think he says.
Right.
I think you do have to draw a clear line. But I do understand the government. Governance, you know it in your states, you know it in your cities, requires bringing people around to your position, building a majority. I think it's a little different for presidents. I think presidents can use the bully pulpit to set the sights higher than perhaps where we can get with majority rule, but they can move the nation. And on things like health care, that's exactly what we're going to have to do, because this isn't, I don't think incrementalism is going to serve us on that department. We'll just have a poorly funded state program that, you know, everyone ends up ruling a disaster and a failure.
I agree, but I wonder, is a candidate who's supported by Rupert Murdoch and the likes of Rupert Murdoch, and a candidate who offers Ronald Reagan as the model.
If them's our options. Now, I do think that the Obama statement about Reagan has been rather misconstrued. And I do think that Murdoch is giving support to Hillary Clinton because he'll support anyone he thinks is a leader and has the power to, you know, is likely to become the powerful in Washington. If you read some of his papers, though, in New York, it's not like the papers are suddenly endorsing this woman. They're not.
No. Right.
But anyway, Barry, we've got to take a break. I appreciate your call. It's exactly the kind of thoughtful listener I know that Tom Hartman has. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to me on The Tom Hartman Show. We'll be back with more of your calls and with our first guest, Hugh Jackson from the Las Vegas Gleaner. Glean what you can and then come back.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
We're back. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to The Tom Hartman Show. I'm sitting in for Tom, and this is Air America Radio. Our number is 866-303-2270, 866-303-AAR0. The question on the table is, with our fascination about the state of the slate, the presidential slate, that is, are we kind of losing it with respect to the state of our state? Just one tiny little news item that caught my attention today. We, this country, is now a proud member of the Canadian government's watch list of countries that could practice torture. Yeah, we are now, the U.S. is now on the Canadian government's torture watch list. Rah, 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 bravo, bravo. And who says we can't make impact in the world in this country under our contemporary leadership? That's where that's gotten us. All right. It's just by way of emphasis that there is such a thing as a bigger picture out there, no matter how fun this new national series known as the presidential primaries has become. All right, first guest, Hugh Jackson's with us. He's the editor and proprietor of the Las Vegas Gleaner. He also writes as a journalist independently there in Las Vegas, covering politics in Nevada and beyond. Hugh, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I don't want to downplay the importance of your election tomorrow, but gee, read the coverage and you would think it will change the world.
Well, I actually had a line in a piece the other day that said, look, I didn't want to be a buzzkill, but barring unimaginable circumstances of some enormous magnitude, Nevada was not in fact going to settle who the Democratic nominee would be. You know, it's just not going to happen. But you know what? We're having a lot of fun watching them come through, and and lay waste and scorch the earth to the party during the course of trying to attack each other. So.
Oh, dear. So, well, let's talk about the good news first. And the good news I'm thinking of is the possibility, I read this in the Las Vegas Sun today, that based on the polling out there right now, John Edwards is a real contender. Hey, he could even pull out a good number of delegates from Nevada.
Yeah, you know, he's always had a strong organization here. He obviously was hoping to get the endorsement of the Culinary Union, which is Unite Here's arm. They are widely expected to be the 800-pound gorilla. He didn't get that, so he soldiers on. Frankly, when he did not get the Culinary Union's nod last week, I was wondering whether he would ride off Nevada altogether. But I talked to him yesterday. He was here yesterday. He was here this morning. He will be leaving this afternoon, but he has been here campaigning. So, you know, we'll see what's going to happen. There are polls, and, you know, which obviously the polling worked so wonderfully in New Hampshire, but in any
okay.
case, there are polls here that right now the latest ones show Clinton ahead and Obama behind and Edwards distant, but most of the pollsters will say that, you know, Nevada's never done this before. Nobody knows how many people are going to show up at the caucus, and anything can happen.
How many people normally participate, or rather, how many people participated last time in the caucus?
Oh, gosh, it was like 9,000 or something like that.
But and are there projections for how many could take part this time?
Projections are ranging everywhere from 30,000 to the great and powerful Harry Reid has suggested it might be as many as 100,000. I have absolutely no idea. I think it'll probably, wild stab, I guess it might be something around maybe 50, 60,000, which will certainly be
huge.
What's that?
That would be huge.
Well, it would be huge in the compared to lowball estimates, but in terms of as a representation of the number of registered Democrats in the state, it would be maybe 10%.
That gets to the question of the democratic nature of this primary and caucus process overall. And when you open that can of worms, you really wonder what you're excited about.
Well, and I've been I have a column this week in a paper called City Life where I write a column. One of the free weeklies with sex ads in the back, as I like to say. But in there, I hope that this is the very last time Nevada has a caucus.
No, no. Everything I've heard from everybody else we've talked to in Nevada is how excited they are, that the candidates are having to come to Nevada, talk to their issues. People are engaged. The caucus is a deliberative process. It's not just, you know, pulling a lever privately in a polling station. You're the only one I've heard say, please don't let this happen to us again.
Well, I love the candidates coming here and talking about stuff, and I have taken advantage of it as much as anybody else. I've had the opportunity to interview these folks and ask them questions at press conferences and see their appearances, and it's certainly closer to a presidential campaign than I've ever been in my life,
mm-hmm.
even though I did used to be an actual journalist with a paycheck and stuff. But, you know, the caucus system itself is patently unfair. It is rigged to give people more influence than others because there are always Byzantine formulas about how the delegates are calculated to the conventions. There's no secret vote, which I think is an abomination and an affront and an offense. And of course, there's no absentee voting. The window that you must show up in is very small. I mean, amongst the more egregious examples of disenfranchisement as a result of a caucus system is that the people who are serving their third or fourth tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan cannot participate.
Yeah.
And so.
And not just them either. There's a huge story in today's Wall Street Journal about the Latino vote possibly being artificially reduced because of bureaucratic stonewalling and foot dragging when it comes to giving legal green card holders their actual, citizenship status. They've apparently got a backlog today unlike anything ever seen before, and it started, surprise, surprise, just in time to carry us through the primary season and maybe through November of this year.
Yeah.
So it's not that democratic. There's also the question of, well, on that level, I'd love to get your take on the decision that came down from the federal judge on the caucus site dispute. Give us your take on that, and what's the significance of the judge's decision?
Well, very, very briefly, what happened there was the Culinary Union, which has 60,000 members and who knows how many of them are going to show up to caucus, had endorsed Barack Obama.
Right.
Meantime, the caucus rules had been established, and they had set up these at-large caucus sites so that casino workers, when they were working Saturday, which is when a lot of them work, obviously, this being a tourist town, they could take a half hour, go to big, large caucus sites at casinos themselves and you know, participate in the process. This had been spoken of all along by everyone involved as a wonderful thing, yet another unique element of the Nevada process, because we were going to bring labor into the process like no other state would, and Latinos, because so many Latinos are working in the casinos and such. Lo and behold, 2 days after Obama gets the endorsement, a suit is filed claiming that these at-large caucus sites are unfair, violation of equal protection, give more clout to, or more influence to, the Culinary Union's membership than they do to other workers in the state, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this suit was thrown out yesterday by the judge, who basically said state parties can do whatever the hell they want when they're running a caucus. It's not a state caucus, it's a party-operated affair. And besides, you guys filed this thing way too late, and so he threw it out. Getting back to what I was talking about earlier, I think that the people that brought this suit, and while some of them are clearly supporters of Hillary Clinton, others apparently are not. But this is, you know, if you don't feel that the Clinton campaign appreciated this effort, it would require a willing suspension of disbelief.
Did hear from Bill Clinton that he, in a sense, supported the suit. Pretty.
Oh yeah, he became unhinged with that poor reporter.
He may be unhinging. I think he may be unhinging before our very eyes.
But so anyway, you know, the intellectually and conceptually, the argument behind the suit is not without merit.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. There is some disproportionate representation going on, could be, especially depending on if there's a very heavy turnout. But this goes back to, we don't really know what the actual disrepresentation might be, because it hinges on these bizarre formulas that are encased within the caucus rules. And those formulas, I might add, also are designed to give, for instance, rural voters in Nevada more influence than urban voters, because, you know, in this country right now, if there's one thing we love to do politically, it's genuflect and suck up to the heartland, you know. so there's a lot of that going on. And
well,
and
I mean, just by way of perspective, I think you said there might be between 30 and 50,000 participating. We probably have close to that in a 5-block radius where I live.
Well, yes.
We don't get to choose.
Yeah.
If we did, we would perhaps have different candidates. But anyway, going back, one other question I want to ask you on the question of how this may be playing out, because I hear you there may be some merits to the case, but the politicization of how the challenge happened is undeniable. It doesn't look good for the folks who stood to gain by it, and it certainly doesn't look good for the process. There's another issue that it seems to me could leave the party, or at least the top two candidates, Clinton and Obama, in sort of sad shape tomorrow, and that is this tussle over gaming. Hillary Clinton, since Obama, did get the culinary workers' endorsement, and they're the folks who work the strip, among other things, has started talking about how bad gaming is for poor people, and amping up instead her focus on the economic crisis facing poor Nevadans. In that stink, and Obama, to be fair, is somebody who has criticized gaming in the past, but he's done that less so since he got the endorsement. In that sort of dust-up, could John Edwards end up smelling sweeter?
Well, there's that dust-up. There's the dust-up that they've been at, that Clinton, Obama have entered into over some Yucca Mountain stuff, over, you know, who gets most money from the nuclear power industry. So and just the general, and the fight over the lawsuit that we were talking about. You take those types of things together, and there are others where the two perceived to be leading candidates are fighting with each other, and maybe they do open a door for Edwards. I mean, one thing about campaigns, and you know this, is that, that most campaign tactics are not designed to bring out your supporters. Rather, they are designed to keep your opponent's supporters home. And with Obama and Clinton both going after each other and trying to soften their support, then maybe it does leave an opening for Edwards. Mm. It's possible.
But you sounds like you're worried that the whole process isn't good, really, for the people of the state of Nevada, or maybe the image of our democracy.
Well, at any election, the business that I talked about how tactics trying to suppress your opponent's support instead of boosting your own, I think that applies to every election in this country from coast to coast. I don't think that's just a Nevada-specific phenomenon.
But you don't want no caucus coming back to you anytime early.
You know, I hope, and what I've urged is that the state change to a primary system where, you know, people can actually go vote at their convenience, do absentee voting. Nobody knows how they're voting. You know, I love the idea of Nevada being early in the process. I think that's great, but I would just like to see us shift to a primary instead of a caucus.
All right. Well, I thank you for that, Hugh. Interesting thinking, and I think you've got a point. Hugh Jackson writes for the Las Vegas Gleaner. That's his blog, Las Vegas Gleaner. Is it .com? I think it is, lasvegasgleaner.com. Do check it out. It'll be the place to go, I would say, for the earliest commentary and probably the smartest commentary on tomorrow's primary. What have you got? What's going to be your strategy for covering? Not the primary, but the caucus. You.
Well, you know what? I still haven't made up my mind whether I'm going to cover it primarily or whether I'm going to participate in it.
Well, you've got to do both.
Well, but if I covered it, then I would want to go down to one of the at-large precincts probably and watch how that's going to happen, or maybe go to the filing center and watch the information come in real time. Whereas if I participate in it, I have to go to my precinct place a few blocks down the road. And I still haven't decided which I'm going to do.
Sounds like you need an Eager Beaver volunteer reporter.
Well, this just underscores my objection to the caucus system.
Hugh, thank you so much. It's really great to hear from you. We will be checking out the vlog over the next few days, you can be sure. LasVegasGleaner.com, folks. When we come back, more of your calls. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to Air America Radio. Welcome back. I'm Laura Flanders. So here are the stats from the National Priorities Project. The projected cost of the war or occupation of Iraq for fiscal year 2008 now stands at, remember what they told us it would be? Remember what they told us? $200 million? Well, for the whole thing? Well, it now stands at $156 billion just for the next year. It may ultimately consume, let's not forget, some $2 trillion. $156 billion in 2008. That's enough, according to the National Priorities Project, to provide health care for 44 million Americans. That's just a little under the total number of people entirely lacking health care. It's enough to build 1.2 million new housing units, otherwise known as homes. It's enough to provide 161 million homes with renewable energy. How could that help the people of Nevada? How could that help the people where you live? Health care, housing, renewable energy. If we allow our conversation about spending on this war to be put second to partisan considerations of scoring against the other guys, or not wanting to cast a shadow on the rather cowardly positions of our candidates, if we allow this question of spending on the war to be backburnered still further, it's not just putting any old issue on the back burner. It's not just doing any old little bit of political calculus. It's doing a bit of political calculus and putting the thing on the back burner that is at the heart of the rest of our national crisis. Whether you're talking about the out-of-control national executive, federal executive, whether you're talking about our health care crisis or our recession. Just to say, people, that as we get absorbed in the presidential race, keep your head above water. Keep your eyes on some kind of a prize. We need to make some real change. And if we allow, for example, the invisibilizing, if you will, of the positions of Richardson or Kucinich, who at least during their time in the allowed to participate in the debate and choosing to participate in these presidential races, put out a clear position. No more forces in Iraq, bring them home now. No permanent bases. We're allowing the most important national debate of our time, this presidential debate, to take place without the most important national issue, which is the issue of funding of this war. I'm just putting it out there. It's one example of the kind of question that I think we need to grapple with as Americans, fun as it is, to focus on the new national TV series of our primary and caucus season. I'm Laura Flanders. We'll have a whole lot more. We'll talk about issues large and small, little things like nanotechnology, and big things like veterans' health care. They're both huge issues. I'm Laura Flanders. This is the Tom Hartman Show. We'll be back after the headlines.
The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
The radical middle, that's us, I guess. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Tom, wherever you are, I hope you're having fun doing good and changing the world, as I bet you are. I'll be here for the next couple of hours, and we've got a great show continuing. In this hour, we will hear about nasty, or maybe not so nasty, newly manipulated little atoms and molecules that could bring you better skincare products, but might also have implications we know nothing about. The fact that they haven't been adequately tested is part of a bigger picture of a shortage of attention to some of the domestic duties of government. You know, there are shortages, staffing shortages, in just about every agency, whether you're looking at border security, there was a story about that today, or, the State Department, we know about that. Condoleezza Rice can't beg, borrow, and steal people to come and work in Baghdad, for example, in that lovely, enormous embassy they've built. They can't find anybody who wants a job. You've got shortages and the EPA, because people have been so completely alienated from the politicization of that agency. Also, I can't find an agency when I did a search that wasn't complaining of shortages. FEMA, the Veterans Administration, the Department of Transport even. Everyone's suffering from a lack of staffing, because who wants to work in this government? It just leaves a nasty taste in the mouth. So it's part of the conversation we're having about where are our priorities, what's really ailing this nation, and can we afford to get ourselves so excited in the presidential race that we kind of forget the state of our states. The number is 866-303-2270, 866-303-AARZ. There isn't a blog functioning at the Tom Hartman radio site, so here's my email address. If you want to email me, and I'll promise to look at it at least a couple of times during the show, it's Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at, I think it's Laura at LauraFlanders.com, I think. It's also Laura at RadioNation.com if you want to use that address, and I know that works. Anyway, Laura at LauraFlanders.com if you want to send email there. Let's take some calls, and in this part of the program, let's take a bunch of calls in a relatively quick succession. Let's start, Simon in Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Simon.
Hello, Laura.
How are you doing?
Doing pretty well, thank you.
So what do you think?
I'm calling about the Democratic nominees,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very concerned about who is going to get the nomination, and I see a lot of focus, people trying to decide who's the most qualified candidate. And my take on it is that they're all pretty much, they're equal. You know, there's one has one strength, another weakness, and, you know, basically, if we can get any one of them elected, we'll be okay. So the question becomes, which one is most electable?
So the only qualification you're looking for is electability, but how do we assess that?
Well, that's a good question. So my theory is that it's a fairly equal divide in our country right now between kind of, you know, progressive and conservative, or however you want to classify them. And so the most electable person will be the person who is most able to capture the opposing party's undecided voters.
And well, that's been the strategy every candidate has taken over the last many elections. There is another strategy, you know.
Yes.
And that is to mobilize the non-voters, which is exactly what both Kerry, I mean, what both Edwards and Obama, even to a greater extent, have been focusing on.
Well, I think that's an important thing to do as well. But my biggest concern is, and I haven't made a decision here yet, but my concern is the Republican smear tactics that we've seen so often in the past elections, and how detrimental that's been to the Democratic candidate.
So your strongest candidate becomes the one that has a movement best able to defend against smears.
Not only best able to defend, but least amount of
smear.
Things that need to be defended against.
Least amount of smearability.
Yes, least amount of baggage and whatnot. And to me, although I probably agree with, I guess I'm saying I think Edwards might be the candidate that has that least smearability factor.
Well, all right. I'm going to leave it there and see what other people think. We could talk about that for a while. Let's take another caller, Rob in Minnesota. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Laura.
Where do you think we pick the candidates stand in terms of smearability? Well, you don't have to answer that question.
Smearability, it's where it doesn't really make a difference. You know, I mean, this idea of I'm a progressive, I'm a conservative. I don't care what you are as far as an American right now. We all want America to be better.
We would like to get off the Canadian government's torture list.
Well, again, you know, I mean, to be able to make America better, how do you finally get there?
Well, that's the question.
To be able to finally, opinions mean nothing. To be able to finally get together and say, we want America better. Isn't that what we all want?
Well, it is, and it's what every candidate is saying that they will promise. So I'm not getting any smarter or wiser here, Rob.
Well, no, I mean, to be able to take and go into the slaughter as far as being able to be able to take and pick this candidate or the other one, it's a matter of how do you finally get there, you know, and can America finally vote with their mind instead of their feelings?
Well, if they do that, who would they vote for in your view?
Oh, that's just it. It's where, you know, I mean, George Bush would have not won the last election if people would have thought before they voted.
But you can keep saying that till the cows come in, Rob, or the pigs, or any other livestock breed you want to mention. The fact is, people are influenced by how they feel about a candidate. Study after study after study shows it. And we may rail against it, we mind over matter people, but frankly, emotional gut response is disproportionately influencing how people pull those levers.
Yes, and the whole thing is guess what? You know, I mean, it doesn't make a difference who is right. We have to be right.
All right. Well, I'm not sure I know what to do based on listening to you, Rob, but I appreciate the call. Thanks for it. Hank in Portland. Hi, Hank. Oh, maybe we lost Hank. Oh, there you are. Hi, Hank.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, you were discussing with the gentleman from Nevada about the caucuses being in the hotels.
Right, some of them.
And the hotel workers possibly having a little more clout. And speaking to that, where John Edwards is being endorsed by the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, which I'm a member of.
Right.
And there we have locals in the Nevada area. One local alone has over 10,000 members.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an example, if you don't mind me interrupting, is an example of the media's utter failure to cover campaigns well. I mean, we have national campaign correspondents that parachute in with the candidates. They are unfamiliar with the field on the ground, the scene on the ground. So the story becomes the culinary because, yes, they're a big powerhouse union in the South, and I think they are a big story, and I wrote about them in my book Blue Grit, but they're not the only union in the state.
Right. No, we're not. And, you know, and what was, well, the way I took what he was saying was that Obama was going to have too much of a lead because of the culinary workers. And I don't think that'll be it'll be a part of the factor. But still, you have other unions that are endorsing other candidates.
Yeah, there's no question. And Edwards was out there. He's been out there for a year. He was out there last year campaigning for the AFL-CIO to raise the minimum wage. I mean, this is a guy who has a strong union base. There are more than just the culinary in the way of unions in Nevada. I think that Hugh was talking about one particular story, but I think that you're absolutely right. This isn't a one-union state, and an endorsement, after all, isn't an instruction to your members who they must vote for. So thanks for the call, Hank, and let's try to maintain as open a view as we can. Let's hear from Louis, is it, or Louis in Manhattan? Louis.
Hi. Here's my situation here.
Okay.
I see this as a Walt Disney state of mind. There's no political solution to the problem this country is facing. This is a criminal procedure that needs legal coercion into the American courts of law, because we have states collapsing economically. And this buying of state sovereignty is against the Constitution. We need RICO law statutes to subpoena people from the states to bring back due process of law. These people have run rampant and are plundering this country, and we're looking for political solutions. They've crossed that line a long time ago.
Well, if I understand you correctly and you're calling for a judicial criminal solution, I don't think you're wrong. I'm with you. I have been one of those saying the Democrats should be stronger supporting the people's passionate call for impeachment.
But it's not just Republicans.
It's not just Republicans, but hey, if we're going to say that the buck stops somewhere, you stop with the most powerful person. So I think we should start there. Thanks, Louis. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about nanotechnology and why you should be, well, I think, why you should be afraid. Stay tuned. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. You can email me. Thank you, most of you, for your email. The email address is, I clarified, laura@lauraflanders.com. laura@lauraflanders.com. You can also call us on 866-303-2270. We'll get to more of your calls in just a bit. We are asking whether we're sort of missing the big stuff because we're focused on the smaller stuff. I mean, if the smaller stuff is the personal differences between the candidates on the Democratic side of the presidential nomination fight and how they are affecting the 30,000 max voters who will probably show up in Nevada. Are we maybe missing some of the big important things facing this nation at this time? That's our question. Well, maybe not. We have with us on the line Terry Allen, whose story this week is just one example of the kind of stuff that's going on so far beneath the radar of our consciousness at this point that, hey, you would be well forgiven for having no idea that it was happening at all. She writes a regular column for In These Times. If you don't know In These Times, you should. It's a progressive out of Progressive Magazine out of Chicago. We'll give you the link before we're done. Terry has a piece this week on nanotechnology. It has to do with itty-bitty particles, but it might have very macro-big implications. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Laura.
Tell us about nanotechnology and what's the problem? Nicer skin products? What have you got? What's the beef?
Well, the problem is we don't know enough about it. It's one of these technologies that, like biotechnology, corporations have embraced and put a lot of money into, and we have no idea what the effects are. Nanotechnology, yes.
Yeah,
nanotechnology.
It sounds a little bit like, nuclear power.
Yes. I mean, we get these unintended consequences way down the road that could have been considered before we got into the mess, but instead we're having to clean up, in the case of nuclear, enormous piles of waste that could have been prevented had the technology been thought out ahead. Well, we're now embarking on this new technology, which is taking tiny, tiny particles, a billionth of a meter. It's the amount that your fingernail grows in a second. It's tiny, tiny, and they're shaving these particles off the molecular and atomic size off things like silver and zinc and titanium, and incorporating them into products, and products you use every day. The sunscreen you put on, your anti-wrinkle clothing, your anti-stain fabric, all of these incorporate nanoparticles.
Now, is that what they mean when they advertise new and improved? They've just messed with the particle a bit?
It could be that. And some of them, like the anti-stain, and the, you know, I mean, how clean do your clothes have to be, really? You know, and it's all tied up in their obsession of antibacterial, and because some of these nano... The thing is that when they're taken to that level, the particles behave differently. So, for example, zinc that's used in sunscreen or titanium, when it's a big particle, it's white. When you take it down to the nano level, it's clear. So you can see why the cosmetic manufacturers want to use a clear product rather than a white product that you slop on your skin for sun protection. So that's what they're doing. But we don't know what these particles are doing. And there's some evidence. There are studies that are saying that it may be carcinogenic, and some of that has turned up in rats. It may flow through the blood-brain barrier, which means it's affecting our systems in ways we don't know. And we just have no idea. And hundreds of products in daily use are using this technology. And, you know, then you get to the question of, what's the government doing?
Well, who's responsible? I mean, which government agency is supposed to do something?
Oh, you know, it's the usual mess. It's the FDA and the EPA are both involved, and which has responsibility over which kind of, which particular product is a question. And also you get to cosmetics, and nobody has authority over cosmetics. Cosmetics don't make health claims, and they don't have to be tested, and they don't have to be approved in terms of, you know, except for some very basic considerations.
If I have some new and improved, very exciting skin cream, it could be new and improved because it includes some bit of mercury or something?
Well, probably not mercury, but it could include silver, or it could include zinc.
And it's
titanium.
Never been tested in the way that my new and improved Coca-Cola perhaps has been new and improved?
We already know that's bad for you. This we don't know. And, you know, it could have really wonderful effects. It could be used to target cancer cells, and it could be used in anti-pollution devices. And it's not to say that, you know, we need to panic and say all nanotechnology is dangerous, all nanotechnology is evil, and it's just corporations, heaven forfend, just going out to make a buck and racing ahead with something they don't know anything about when they think they can make a fortune. Well, that part we know. But the part of whether it's dangerous or not, we don't know because we haven't tested it, and it's out in the market widespread. And it's estimated that there will be $1 trillion worth of nanotechnologically influenced manufacturing product by 2015.
Oh, Terry, it is a huge story and a classic example of the kind of thing that is just running beneath the radar, and we could be paying for in years to come. I mean, nobody has even yet really established what the effects of having released strontium-90, a whole new particle, into the atmosphere with atmospheric testing. I thank you for your reporting, Terry. It's another reason to keep our eye on government, and we'll be talking more about that as the program continues.
Thank you for what you're doing. Bye-bye.
Bye, Terry. If people want to find out more about In These Times, go to inthesetimes.com. Inthesetimes.com. We'll be back with more after the break. All right, coming up in this part of the program, we'll take more of your calls, and then we'll go to Washington to hear from the folks at the Talk Radio News Service about what's going down over there. Meanwhile, apparently somebody called Canada. This is Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom Hartman. That's Laura Flanders, and I believe you can email me, laura@lauraflanders.com, or laura@radionation.org, if you'd prefer. Shall I go more slowly? Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at radionation, or one word. .org. That's the name of the show. I do hear weekends for Air America, and you can find out more about that at my website or at the Radio Nation site, which is maybe the easiest to find, radionation.org. All right. Well, somebody emailed me, Lauren from Canada, saying, I wish the U.S. was on our torture list, but according to the following, they're not. Apparently somebody called Canada. At least that's what I'm reading between the lines here. Sure enough, a foreign affairs document identified the U.S. and Israel, actually, as countries it suspects of practicing torture. The document was apparently a PowerPoint presentation that was supposed to instruct Canadian diplomats. It was never supposed to become an item of international news, as it did. It's been a story all over the papers today. The document lists Guantanamo Bay as a place where torture is likely practiced. It also talks about some of the techniques the U.S. uses, blindfolding and forced nudity, as torture, and defines them as torture. Well, that PowerPoint does not represent national policy, says Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the conservative who's been desperately trying to cozy up to the Bush-Cheney White House. And that apparently is the state of play right now. The Office of Foreign Affairs Minister Maxime Bernier has apparently been encouraged. She has moved to disavow the document. I would say she was nudged to disavow the document. And so even though this presentation lists U.S. interrogation techniques under the definition of torture, meaning blindfolding, hooding, forced nudity, isolation, steep deprivation, sleep deprivation, they're not even getting into things like waterboarding, but even just the things we admit we do, well, even though those techniques do come under the definition of torture, in this training PowerPoint, the foreign minister is saying it is not a formal statement of policy, and it's not mean that the U.S. is on the Canadian torture watch list. No word on what that means for Israel. All right, thanks for emailing that in, Lauren. I appreciate it. Not sure what to think about it exactly, except for the North American Alliance is clearly alive and well, even if civil liberties aren't. And I would imagine a whole lot of Canadians are super confused. All right, 866-303-2270. You can just imagine the training session. Yes, this is torture, but we don't call it torture. We're Canadian, we're not American, we just sound like them right now. All right, some more calls. Let's hear from Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania.
Hi, Laura, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Guest hosting.
It's no low bar that Tom sets.
And what country, a democratic country, industrialized country, is going to have an official policy about another democratic country having a torture being practiced? I want the next democratic president to have the leadership skills to do four things right away. And that would be first to do all possible to defend the Constitution and restore our confidence in it and ourselves instead of being scared cats. Second, we need a real assessment of terroristic threats, and we need to get out of Iraq and close down our torture centers. Third, we need to honestly and legally deal with all the political toadies illegally hired by this administration for civil service jobs whose mission will be to cause mischief and to weaken a democratic administration.
Yeah, I mean, the civil service, just to cause you to pause for a minute there, Bonnie, is a huge question. It's a huge issue, it seems to me. You have either political cronies who've been appointed to work in jobs for which they're not qualified but have only won thanks to their loyalty to the Bush agenda and the Bush bankroll. And on the other hand, you have disaffected, furious people leaving because they're so disgusted by what's happened to their departments, to their agencies.
It's a big job, and it's going to require a good team to come up with some good ideas to solve that problem.
And again, it's not just you're going to have to come up with a good team. You're also going to have to re-inspire people about public service.
Again, it goes back to being, you know, having confidence in ourselves as a nation, as employees, everything. And lastly, I want the next president to articulate an independent energy policy that weans us from King Kong, Kong being coal, oil, nuclear, and gas, because we need to generate those quality green opportunities and self-sufficiency.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and that would be your priority. And do you hear any of the candidates standing out on that front, Bonnie?
Well, I like Kucinich, but I'm supporting Edwards. I like him as well because he just seems to have a little bit more support.
All right. Thanks for that. Now, of course, Kucinich would have more support if he had you, but hey, we've been around that wheel many times. Let's take a call. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Yeah, hi. I was just calling up about you were talking about the smear factor.
Yeah.
Well, basically, it's not so much as the smear factor we've had a problem with. It's reacting to those who use smear tactics.
So it's not the smearability of the candidate. It's the smear eagerness, the smear willingness of the smearers.
Well, it's not just that. It's just our reaction to it.
Uh-huh.
You know, too often we take the high road. We don't react quickly enough or hard enough. You know, it's like the old Chicago thing about taking a knife to a gunfight. You know, we're not reacting quickly enough or sharp enough.
Well, what about that? I mean,
prepared.
Let's do you see where do you see the smears so far in this race? I mean, you're referring, I'm imagining, to John Edwards' lackluster response to the Swifbo campaign of 2004.
Well, not just that, but for Gore also. I mean, they knocked him as being a liar. He invented the internet.
Mm-hmm.
He wear earth tones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had what's her name? I can't think of her name now. On the front page of the New York Times. You know, talking about his earth tone clothing.
Mm-hmm. Although she says she never did that.
Just so marginalized, balderdash, and they did nothing. And it's like, you know, he's a liar, and everything he says is a lie. You know, everything he says was true. You know,
well, but so far, I mean, look at this race. You do have an immediate response by the candidates to the allegations and the charges thrown at them. But when they respond, I mean, Hillary Clinton flipped her position on the Elliott Spitzer immigration bill in New York. When she flipped that position, she was seen as a wobbler. She flipped it for reasons that she thought made sense, but it didn't work for her to respond to the attacks either.
Well, yeah, but not responding is even worse, because then you're saying it's true. You know, I am a liar. You're saying everything you said about me is true, because you know what? I'm not responding at all. And all you have to do right now, what we have to do is go, this is an ad campaign. Everything the Republicans say then, everything that they have done, and what they're saying now. They said this then, they're saying this now. You know, people change their mind. They're not flip-floppers.
Well, how do you think John Edwards
has
done on that? How do you think John Edwards has done, Richard, in saying, you know, I voted one way when I was in the Senate and I'm voting another way now? Oh, I'm advocating a different position now because I've changed.
Well, sometimes it is because he's seen the light. He's grown up. He's been educated.
Well,
sometimes it's really just a perception.
I agree with you, and I think that if you're in politics, as we all are, we have to believe that people are capable of changing, but you have to admit the media really
The second biggest problem is, because whatever they say, they're not reporting. They say a lot, they do a lot, and it absolutely goes right over their heads or under the radar or whatever you want to call it. So they have to have their own way of getting the message out.
So your argument would be
said,
that the candidate really needs to be the candidate who can most effectively fight back against the smear.
Absolutely.
All right. All right. We'll take that into account. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the call, Richard. Let's hear very quickly from George and Charlotte, and then we've got to go to break.
Yes, Laura.
Yeah.
I wanted to speak to, I feel that the media has guided us to the candidates that they feel the Republicans can beat.
Well, there you have the understatement of the month, I think.
I feel like Hillary, you have Democrats and Republicans that will not vote for her, mostly because of her voting record, and Obama because of his non-voting record. He says he didn't vote for the war, but I don't think...
Well, he wasn't in the Senate.
He wasn't in the Senate, but when he did get in the Senate, he supported it.
Yeah, and he didn't vote for Kyle Lieberman on Iran, but he didn't vote at all.
And also, for whatever reason, Kucinich gets no attention in the media whatsoever, negative or positive.
Yeah, Kucinich mostly gets the negative, if he gets any. I mean, you're right, they have two things to gain when they ice out to somebody like Kucinich. They not only ice out a candidate who is presenting, you know, who is presenting a challenge to them, but they're also icing out somebody who changes the debate and changes what the priorities are. I mean, you have to admit that I don't think the Kucinich campaign has done well at building its base, particularly between elections, and it's kind of a shame he hasn't been able to win over the progressive caucus of the capital of the federal government, you know, the congressional progressive caucus to his support. I think there's some weaknesses to his movement strategy, but certainly his presidential platform is the toughest it gets.
I think part of the problem is, Laura, is that he's against nuclear energy,
mm-hmm.
and he's competing with GE.
But you can't have it both ways. You can't say that the media is manipulating our attention to support the candidates they think will be the weakest against the right, and at the same time say that they're manipulating to keep a candidate like Kucinich out. Because in some ways, given the public opinion of this country, it would be, you know, their strategy to put somebody like Kucinich forward because they don't actually believe he could win.
Well, he will get my vote.
Well, good. So he should. I appreciate that. Thanks for calling in, George. We'll come back with more after the break. We have a lot of work to do.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
We're back. I'm Laura Flanders, and it's Friday. It is really Friday, and you can call us on 866-303-2270. Sitting in for Tom Hartman. Well, the news from D.C. that I can see is that President Bush has acknowledged the risk of recession and embraced about $145 billion worth of tax relief. That, after all, the advice he was given that tax relief wouldn't actually relieve the economy and the only way to do it was a stimulus package? For more on what the heck is happening in D.C., we have Talk Radio News' own Ellen Ratner. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Laura. I got to tell you, before I get to the economy, and we just had a briefing with the Secretary of the Treasury, I want to just tell you, he's back. Henry Kissinger.
No.
Is meeting with the president today. He is also going to be meeting with the Russians. Apparently there are bilateral informal talks of which Henry Kissinger is a part of.
And now
with
I wonder whose side he's on. I mean, isn't he consulting as a lobbyist for the Chinese, probably the Russians too? He's a big pal of Bush's. Does he just talk to himself in those negotiations?
It is really quite staggering when I heard that the president of the United States is meeting with Henry Kissinger and some representatives unofficially from the Russian government for informal bilateral talks.
I bet both laterals have Kissinger sitting on them.
I'm sure he's got it every way possible. Now, back to this.
So to just carry up, to follow on our ill taste of yesterday, the softening where Henry Kissinger's concerned doesn't seem to be taking effect.
Absolutely not. I mean, when I heard that, I almost fell off my chair. And unfortunately, most of the press is, of course, for reasonable reasons, interested in the economy. And that kind of slid by everybody today.
There is no way that Henry Kissinger can.
On that tomorrow.
There's no way that Henry Kissinger can slide by Ellen.
Not at all. So anyhow, we had the morning gaggle on the economy, and then of course we had the afternoon with Lazier, who is chairman of the Council on Economic Advisers, and Secretary Paulson. So little old me, what do I know about the economy? I asked him about the manufacturing base going over, and where did in the next 2 to 3 years they see the economy growing? In what sectors? Well, the answer I got was that in terms of manufacturing, they're saying that the U.S. still has the largest manufacturing base, and that in the 50s, 30% of our economy, employing 15 million people, was in manufacturing. Today, it's 10% of our economy, 15% in manufacturing. But because of automation, our output has increased 7 times. And that basically, manufacturing was still solid in this country. I don't know about you, but that is really quite shocking to me.
That they believe that.
That they actually believe that.
Well, you know, I think it's about as credible as Mitt Romney's pledge to revive automobile construction in Detroit.
Well, he has no plan, Mr. Romney.
But the Michigan voters didn't care.
It worked very well before. Now, one of my people on in the press corps asked a very important question. There has been a number floated around of $250 one time for people on Social Security, and his response was the Christmas season has come and gone, and we're not trying to decorate a Christmas tree.
Oh, that's disgusting. That's just disgusting. I mean, that is such an insult to poor people in this country who are not, for the most part, poor because of anything they're doing or not doing, but because we have a government that's allowing corporations to get away with paying people sub-livable wages. That's
Absolutely. It's just an insult.
Now, Ellen, on the question of the tax, quote-unquote, relief, it's only relief for the very richest, and the stimulus, we were told this morning, all the newspapers said was that the Bush administration was, surprise, surprise, going to actually negotiate, work with the Democrats, that they were on board, he was on board, the White House wasn't going to contest the question of a stimulus package. All I'm reading in the AP wire copy on the announcements this morning is that the Bush administration, that Bush himself was pushing the tax cut part of this picture. What did you hear about the stimulus part?
Well, what they're essentially saying, when asked about that figure that we've seen, $800, all he would say, the secretary would say, is it bigger than a bread box. He would essentially wouldn't say how big it was. But he did say that tax relief will go to consumers, and it'll be approximately 1% of GDP, which is the number that you were talking about when I just came on, which is about $140 to $150 billion.
All this talk of bread boxes and Christmas trees, what world do these people live in?
Well, you know, I want to know who is giving them advice in terms of talking to the press.
Well,
I certainly wouldn't have used any of those images.
I'm happy to hear your take, but I'm afraid a lot of the reporters will gobble this up and spout it out.
Well, perhaps. The other things that that they're talking about, I asked them, again, specifically, where are they going to see the growth? And he said in exports. He did say that the problem, and he also said that unemployment is 5% in the third quarter, and that is still better than it's been in a number of years.
We're running out of time here, but that sounds like they're going to try to sell us the low value of the dollar as an upside.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's exactly what we're hearing.
Oh, Ellen, all right. Well, I hope you will enjoy your weekend, and we will have you back here on the program. I know Tom will on Monday. Thank you so much. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service. We have a whole lot more coming up in the next hour, including the latest on veterans' benefits. Will they be seeing more? Well, yes, just they might. We'll also hear about union input into the Nevada caucuses. Stay tuned. You're listening to Air America Radio, the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Laura Flanders.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. I'm Laura Flanders sitting in for Tom. I'm hoping you're all having a fantastic Friday, and it's going to be an even better weekend. If you want to call in, it's 866-303-2270, 866-303-AAR0. I don't know. The mail seems to be bouncing back. So go to my website, lauraflanders.com. Hit on the contact page, and you will get the website, the address there. It's Laura. It's Laura at Flanders, and it's complicated. It's Laura at the Laura Flanders site. You'll find it there. If you want to talk to the congressman who represents George W. Bush's home district, now is your chance. It's always fun to talk to Chet Edwards, who is chair of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Military Construction, Veterans Affairs, and other things. He does, as I said, represent that district of Texas, the 17th, that includes the president's talked about ranch, but what they say about it is it really isn't a ranch. But anyway, there's good news from the House Appropriations Subcommittee. There's good news, in fact, believe it or not, from Washington. There has been a new package of veterans funds finally released courtesy of the president agreeing to a congressional measure. Here to talk all about it is Representative Chet Edwards of Texas's 17th. Hi, Representative. How are you?
Doing great, Laura. Good to be with you.
So talk about this. I mean, when Democrats took control of Congress, this was one of the big pledges to improve benefits and resources for veterans. It's been a bit of a long time coming, but it seems like something actually is coming at last.
Well, it says great news for veterans. It's a new day for them. We're a new Congress under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, who's made a tremendous commitment to vets. We have increased by an unprecedented amount of funding, $11.8 billion in 1 year. Funding going to improve medical care and benefits and services for veterans. And I think one of the real myths that has been around the country for the last several years that somehow Republicans in Washington are more supportive of veterans than Democrats.
Well, that's not a myth that pertains around here.
Well, the fact is that if you look over the last 6 or 7 years after inflation and increasing number of veterans needing the VA health care services, the Bush and Republican Congress numbers have been pretty much frozen. In fact, in 2006, they didn't even pass a VA appropriations funding increase, and it literally was frozen, and the system was hurting. So Democrats took over in January, and in 12 months, we provided about a 29% increase in medical services and VA funding. And you'd have to add up the VA increases for the last 6 years under Republican leadership in Congress to equal the amount of veterans funding increases we provided in just 1 year.
So that's good news. Now, what kind of, where will this money go? What kind of funding is being appropriated here?
Well, let me just give some examples. For medical services, we go from $22.5 billion as of a year ago to $29 billion. So that's an increase of over $6 billion for medical services. What's that mean to a veteran coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan or a Vietnam veteran, a World War II veteran? It means they won't have to wait in line as long to get a doctor's appointment to look at a bum knee or a serious problem they have.
Any money in there for mental health? I know that until 2004, we'd really seen no increase in mental health services. In fact, a decrease last time I looked. And as I was telling listeners at the beginning of the program, the stats on veterans coming back with severe post-traumatic stress syndrome, I think they've got like a 10% increase in claims, and we know the suicide rate's soaring.
Well, the young veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are facing, understandably, some serious mental health care issues as they stand out on patrol or walk on patrol day after day for a year and then do that two or three cycles in a row on rotations to Iraq or Afghanistan. And some Army estimates are as many as 10 to 20% of our veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan have serious health care issues. And that is exactly why, under Democratic leadership and the new Congress, we increased mental health care funding by $700 million over where we were just a year ago. $2.9 billion for mental health care now versus just $2.2 billion 12 months ago. We put funding in earlier this year for a new polytrauma center in San Antonio. For those are centers to take care of those that have a combination of physical and mental issues or very severe mental or physical problems. It could be traumatic brain injury. It could be post-traumatic stress disorder, a combination thereof. There wasn't a polytrauma center for veterans anywhere in the southwest part of the United States. So we have really put a high priority on taking care of the mental health care needs of our veterans. In fact, every Iraq-Afghan War veteran going into the VA healthcare system now will be automatically tested for both traumatic brain injury and for signs of PTSD. Because if they are having problems, we have learned the hard way that it's better to intervene early. And truly, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure.
What about the infrastructure crisis that we saw when we saw what the state at Walter Reed was of one of their facilities?
Well, we've taken bold action on that for the VA. And while the Walter Reed situation was under the jurisdiction of the Department of Defense and the U.S. Army, I think every American would agree that not one serviceman or woman, not one, and not one veteran should ever have to live in the kind of awful conditions that those soldiers were forced to live in NX-18 at Walter Reed. And that's why in just 12 months we added over $1 billion for non-recurring maintenance at our VA hospitals to ensure that we don't ever have a Walter Reed tragedy occur in our VA healthcare system.
How is the VA doing, in your view, when it comes to the state of its civil service, the staffing there? We were talking earlier about the severe staffing shortages that are cropping up in government agencies at every level. In part, it's political. People don't want to work with political cronies. They feel that public service has been so tainted by the politicization scandals of this administration that they don't want to carry the can for it anymore. At the Veterans Administration, is the atmosphere, the ethic, the morale good?
Well, I think generally it is, because the men and women I've met that, Laura, have been working in the VA, they know their life's cause is an important one, and that is to help men and women who've sacrificed tremendously for our country. So I find both at VA hospitals and at regional offices where they're working on giving veterans the benefits they earn as a result of their service to country, I find they're highly motivated. Now, the problem has been the budgets over the last decade have really made it difficult for fewer VA employees to take care of more veterans in need. And one of the things that I'm very excited about that we've done this past year is to provide the funding that would allow an increase of over 3,100 new VA claims processors. You know, it is just a tragedy and a shame right now that a typical veteran has to wait 6 months to receive his or her earned benefits, and a veteran shouldn't have to wait in line that long. They didn't hesitate to serve their country when called to duty, and they shouldn't have to wait 6 months to get their earned benefits. And I might add a footnote to this, that this additional funding, $3.7 billion we put into the VA system this year, was over the president's budget. In fact, until just a couple of days before I passed my bill on the House last June, the White House was still threatening a veto, and as late as August, they sent me a letter saying they really didn't need this extra $3.7 billion. So I'm glad the president signed the letter yesterday.
I'm glad he did,
money,
too.
But they came along kicking and
screaming. You know what? Now, Congressman Edwards, let me ask you about the process. What did it take to get this passed? And then I've got one more question after that.
Well, the process actually started last January. The Republican Congress in 2006 had failed to pass the VA bill. So they froze VA funding, which really was hurting hospitals that had increasing numbers of vets coming in and healthcare inflation. So we quickly passed a $3.4 billion increase for fiscal year 2007. Then in May, we passed an additional $1.8 billion to take care of mental health care needs and other veterans' needs in the Iraq War supplemental bill. And then finally, in the Omnibus 2008 bill, which the president signed the day after Christmas last year, that's where we had the additional $6.6 billion above what we spent for 2007. But $3.7 billion of that was listed as emergency funding, and the president had to agree to that, which he finally agreed in writing yesterday. And it was interesting. He did it very quietly. You'd think he'd be proud to allow additional $3.7 billion in funding to go to our men and women who served our country in uniform, but they did it quietly without fanfare by sending a letter.
Well, you know, they're trying to shrink federal spending, don't forget, even at this level. I guess my final question, we're talking with Congressman Chet Edwards from Texas, is, there's a solution, of course. There's a way to reduce the number of veterans who are coming back from Iraq in the state that they're coming back, the bills that we're facing as a nation for giving the care they deserve to these folks. There's an easy solution, or at least there's a solution, which is not to send them and to bring them back, not to send any more at the very least. What's going to happen in the House, and how can we hope? Where can we put our hopes, Congressman Edwards, for leadership from the Democrats in the House, not only to deal with these vets, but to reduce their number?
Laura, 2 points. First is, you're absolutely right that taking care of veterans is an important cost and a moral obligation of our being involved in a war in Iraq. And we shame on a nation that would send young men and women to war and not take care of them when they come home.
And the best way to take care of them is not to send them.
Well, there's no doubt about that point. And I think the question, though, frankly, is what can Congress do about it? And I think the frustrating thing to a lot of Democrats is that as long as the president has the veto power, there is just no way to get a two-thirds vote in the House and a two-thirds vote in the Senate.
But you work in a subcommittee. You know that the power you have lies in not bringing these appropriations up for debate.
Yes, we do. But it's what happened right before Christmas when Democrats were talking about not funding the Iraq War and making the president justify his request for additional funding. He didn't threaten to cut off funding to the Iraq War. He was going to threatened to turn out the lights at military bases all over the United States and shut down daycare centers at Fort Hood, Texas, and at Fort Drum, New York.
Do you think he would ever really do that? And do you think that he would not be forced, we could not force him to carry the can if he really did go ahead with such a plan?
I don't know what they're willing to do. I'll be honest with you. I have a hard time predicting what this administration would do on something like this. And there's still a Karl Rove mentality in many cases of playing politics to the hilt. And I know this is a frustrating situation for many Americans and certainly Democrats all over the country. The best way to change the direction of the Iraq War is to change who's sitting in the Oval Office next January.
We'll leave it at that. Thanks so much, Congressman Edwards, Chet Edwards from Texas.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks for being with us. You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Show with me, Laura Flanders. We've got a little bit left coming up. We will hear one more word from Nevada, and we'll hear more of your calls. And I'll give you the details on the Roe v. Wade anniversary coming up next week and where you can go, what you can do to vigil in support of women's choice. I'm Laura Flanders. Stay tuned. You're listening to Air America Radio. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Show. Let's take some of your calls. We have got a couple of vets on the line. Dan in San Luis Obispo. Hi, Dan. Calling in from California. What's
Hello.
On your mind?
Yeah, you know, Laura, I just like to know, you know, they keep appropriating all this money, but where does it go? For advertising on TV or something? You know, the prices keep going up, and they turn it into a welfare program where you got to have insurance. You got to have... Then they want to know everything about your financial situation, all your bank accounts. With their record of losing their computers and stuff, that's not a very wise thing to do. And then if you don't sign this form, they have a threat right underneath it, 5 years imprisonment. Mm. where does that go to? You get sent over to Turkey or someplace?
So this has been your experience? You're a Vietnam vet?
Yeah.
And what is the process of claiming these benefits?
Well, they send you out a form and tell you. So I'm going to quit the VA because of it. Because I just don't.
If you're worried about forms, it's not better out there in the private world.
Pardon?
If you're worried about filling out forms, it's not better out there in the private insurance world.
Well, yeah, but I'll tell you one thing: they don't lose computer information. You know.
Yeah, I mean,
every other day.
Well, that is certainly a point. I remember when I was covering Gulf War Syndrome back in the early 90s and nobody thought it was a fact. The fact of people's medical records being in any one of something like 260 different possible facilities or just being lost was kind of a shocker to me.
Well, yeah, I know that, but, you know, it wasn't that way when I went in when the draft was around.
Yeah.
They didn't say anything about that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it may be true that it's just gotten worse and worse, and it's certainly true that now that there isn't a draft, people with the most power in this society aren't seeing it face up through their families. Dan, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Very quickly, Andrew in Los Angeles. Hi, Andrew. We've got about 30 seconds.
I'm sorry?
We've got about 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. I was calling about whether they were testing veterans mandatorily for uranium-238 in their bloodstreams.
The depleted uranium. Well, you know, they were supposed to, I believe, under the changes, the regimen changes that were implemented after the Gulf War, but the first Gulf War. But it's an excellent question. I'm sorry I didn't get to it, although I'm not sure the congressman would have been able to answer it. That's a whole nother scandal, the depleted uranium in the missiles and in the tanks that our active duty are driving around in.
No kidding. That's about a million or so veterans who are going to get cancer.
Well, or maybe.
Maybe.
Or leukemia.
Hope not.
It's a heavy metal out there. All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. Appreciate the call. Depleted uranium. If you want more information about that, you could certainly Google it. It's a huge story. And we'll talk about, at some point, I hope we'll get to it on this program, either I or Tom, how the new depleted uranium munitions are affecting not only our vets, the stuff aerosolizes into the air and the water and gets into your bloodstream that way, but also the Iraqis. Huge medical threat. I'm Laura Flanders. We'll be back after the break.
Barack Obama.
Democratic contenders Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Because I think Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Barack Clinton and Barack Obama.
Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
Or either Obama or Clinton.
Don't you think that Edwards in particular landed some blows against her?
The opposition is Obama to Hillary.
All right, well, there you go. That is the latest ad from the John Edwards campaign, and I think he's got a point, don't you? And that's our gesture in defiance of the media's imbalanced reporting, I would say, on the three Democratic contenders. All right, I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Tom Hartman. You can find, you'll probably be seeing, if you live in Nevada, you're going to be seeing that advertisement a lot from the Edwards campaign. You've probably been getting your mailbox filled with direct mail these last few weeks and months. What about those door knockers? You know what I read recently? A study from Yale, I think it was, about how many pieces of mail, how many phone calls, and how many knocks on the door it takes you, the voter, to actually go out and vote. Apparently it's something like 600 pieces of mail, 400 phone calls, but only 14 knocks on the door. So if you don't like how many pieces of attention you get, you just got to respond quicker. All right, I'm Laura Flanders. As I said, the number is 866-303-2270. I didn't realize Tom was away on his anniversary. I haven't been listening to the program this week. I had not realized that. So I should have been saying all this time, happy anniversary, happy, I don't know, honeymoon. Did you ever take a honeymoon, you two? Happy, happy. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. I'm going to take a couple more calls, but first I told you I would tell you what you could do to mark the 35th anniversary of Roe v. Wade if you're a defender. You know, when you defend Roe v. Wade, you're not just defending a woman's right to choose. You're defending the idea of women's equality. You know, we may try to softball it all we like and try to pretend it's about something else, just privacy, but really, you know, a woman's ability to control childbearing is a huge and radical question. I'm a feminist. I believe a woman needs to have that control. It needs to be legal to decide when and how many kids to have, because otherwise there's no way in heck we're going to have equality in this society. I'm not going to give you some sort of mushy talk about how it's just an abstraction, privacy, or choice. It's a real thing. And I can understand why there's a fight about it. I don't think there's a whole lot of compromising we can do if we actually believe in women's equality. Should it be legal? Yes. Should you go to jail? No. Should you be criminalized? No. Should your doctor? No. It's as simple as that. Do you have to have an abortion? No. If you don't believe in it, don't have one. But in any case, if you want to celebrate, mark the anniversary, you can join now. The National Organization for Women is going to be having its annual vigil at the Supreme Court. And I think this would be a pretty darn good year for you to show up there. You could also presumably hold your own vigil at your own local state court or even your local city court. Whatever you feel like. But I think this would be a good year to express your support for legal access, legal abortion, and then we can start working more aggressively for access, because legality alone, heaven knows, is not all it takes to have a healthy and equal society. All right, I'm Laura. As I said, I'll take a couple more calls before we go to our last guest of the day, who's going to just give us a flavor once again of how things are shaping up in Nevada around the caucus tomorrow. Let's take a call from... Prez. Are you really called Prez in Sebastopol? California.
Yeah, that's part of my first name. That's actually what I'm called, Laura.
But not the Prez.
No. Let's not go there, please. I wanted to say something really quickly. I used to work at the VA as a nurse. I'm a Vietnam vet. And talking in response to Congressman Edwards, I had a quick comment about John Edwards also. But we need to call their bluff. No more high road. It's very lonely up there on the high road. We need to call their bluff about the funding. Do not bring these bills forward. We need to play hardball, and people would thank them for doing so.
Well, I tried to make that point to Congressman Edwards. What do you think of his response?
The high road. Well, I thought it was the usual.
Yeah.
I've
well,
made-
we can't do this because they might shut off the lights at Walter Reed. Well, let them.
Yeah, call their bluff. That's what I'm saying. Call their bluff.
I agree.
And let everybody see. It's the same thing with impeachment hearings and everything.
I mean, it really does speak volumes to their impression or their belief about the American people. They believe the American people would more quickly believe Karl Rove's version of events than what they could see in front of their eyes, which in such a case would be the president turning off the lights at Walter Reed.
That leads me into my next comment
okay.
I originally called with about John Edwards. If all Rove and Company could get on him with his haircut,
mm-hmm.
they got nothing. They got nothing.
Well,
and they're terrified of him.
Well, I think you might be right. I think you might be right. I thank you for your call, Perez. I really do. All right, let's hear from Jane in Seattle. Hey, Jane.
Okay, I think we should have a movement that we Democrats and people that are paying attention to start a movement to say screw you to the major media and say that we want to vote for Dennis Kucinich or John Edwards.
Well, you have a movement. It was called the Kucinich Presidential Campaign.
No, but I mean everybody, forget Hillary and Obama. Just let them go fight in the corner.
Jane?
They should stay in the Senate anyway.
You live in a nice big city, Seattle. You could organize a group to start raising that right there. My contention is that the Kucinich campaign, excellent though they are on all of the issues, hasn't shown the organizing skill to make itself and their candidate a viable player. And I only come to this after watching now two races. I think it's a disappointment.
Well, it does begin
with organizing, and it begins with organizing where you live. You may love the guy. He may be right on all the issues. But if you can't turn out enough of a grouping even where you live, then it's just, you know, wishful thinking that the country could be persuaded to wake up to the wonders of the Kucinich message.
All right. Now, on Roe v. Wade, I think we should, they paid for advertisements on, you know, Air America, so we should pay for advertisements on Rush Limbaugh and say, like, are you willing to take responsibility for the child born out of wedlock?
Yeah, and they'll say yes, they are, and then they won't
be. Yeah, but in the ghetto of New York City when she was just raped by her father, and now she has to go ahead and have the child, and she doesn't have a job. And
yeah, well, they'll say yes, 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 and then they'll really mean no, no, no. Anyway, thanks for the call. Appreciate it, Jane. If you're in Santa Fe, New Mexico, you can indeed participate in your own local demonstration in support of reproductive rights there. There will be a rally January 22nd at the Roundhouse Capitol in Santa Fe at noon. That was courtesy of Linda writing in. Thanks for the shout out. So that's the 22nd. I think that's Tuesday. Is that right? At the Roundhouse, the Capitol there in Santa Fe, noon. You can get more information, presumably from NARAL, the NARAL Pro-Choice America. All right. I'm Laura Flanders. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back with our last guest and the last word we're going to get on what's happening in Nevada. I'm Laura Flanders. This is Air America Radio. Stay tuned.
The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
We're back. I'm Laura Flanders. You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Congrats to Tom out there actually taking a chance to celebrate his beloved and to take a break. Thanks for letting me sit in here at the mic. You can probably get in one, maybe two last calls, 866-303-2270. But before we wrap up this Friday afternoon, I want to check one more time in with good folks in Nevada to get a taste of the excitement there and some of the planning that's going into the caucus that will take place tomorrow. No population, I would say, has been more mobilized, more activated around this caucus than the labor movement. And here to talk a little bit about what that means on the ground, what that looks like for those of us who aren't out there in the Nevada sun, is Gail Tuslow. She's political consultant to the Nevada State AFL-CIO. Gail, welcome to the program. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Show.
Thank you, Laura.
So
good to talk to you.
You too. Give us a taste. You must be exhausted but also excited. What happens between now and the end of the caucus tomorrow?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very exciting, and we've been working for over a year to engage and motivate union members to participate in the caucuses, and they are. I mean, they're calling us every minute of the hour and getting the final information. Many of them are caucus chairs that were recruited, and I think it will do amazing, just amazing amount of energy for labor here.
Well, I can hear from you how completely all out you have gone into this race. What have been some of the sort of creative things that you've seen that have gotten people involved? There are some who are saying, hey, we're not talking about ending the world here or deciding the presidency. It's just a caucus. Last time around, only about 9,000 people participated. But people have really gotten excited this time around. What have you learned from it, perhaps, about ways to get people engaged?
Well, one of the things we did in labor, we encouraged the candidates to do retail politics here. And all of them did. And they came and they met with labor leaders and labor families and had dinner at labor homes, and I think that really helps generate excitement and engagement.
So you mean retail as opposed to just relying on broadcast TV or radio ads, much as we love radio ads?
Or big rallies. I mean, that's not really retail politics. Small groups and having a chance to ask questions and having your picture taken with the candidate has really been just so informational to folks.
So that really means something to people to get their picture taken with the candidate?
I think it does. I think it really does. Mm-hmm. It's not just the picture. It's being able to ask questions about things they really care about. That's an unusual circumstance.
You betcha. Certainly haven't had that chance here in New York. Now, what have been the key questions people have been raising?
Well, in labor, you know, the freedom to join a union is a big issue, and they ask about that, and the trade situation in the world is a big issue with labor, but also the same issues as everyone else: healthcare, the economy. No question, we have the highest foreclosure rate in the country here, and it's affecting, you know, how everyone's looking at the economy. And then, of course, the Iraq war.
The Iraq war in the national media seems to be receding somewhat into background. There, it's front and center, and the candidates are talking about it?
You know, it is front and center. And I think that the candidates have made it clear that it's really not, you know, the war, the surge is not really working when you're still losing 30 or 40 Americans a week in Iraq. And I think people agree with that. They just want it to be over. And there's never a meeting I haven't been in that the war doesn't come up.
I bet. Now, one of the disturbing stories we haven't really talked about much today is this story that was in the Wall Street Journal about the tremendous backlog of Hispanic and Latino voters seeking citizenship. I'm imagining that's a huge issue there. And, of course, it has implications on a person's ability to vote. These are legal green card holders who applied to be naturalized citizens in 2007, some say in part because they so hated the GOP position on immigration and really wanted to participate in the election. The delay means they're waiting for their citizenship papers, won't be able to participate. Is that a big story there? Do you see that playing out there?
Yeah, we see that play out every day, even among labor. We have a citizenship program that tries to help folks get their citizenship, and that's overwhelmed with backlog and overwhelmed with a backlog trying to move that backlog along. And also unions like SEIU have engaged with trying to get information out there for folks.
Mm. One of the questions that's come through, again, the sort of media machine, not all stories come through and not all the ones that come through are good, but there have been a couple involving unions in the last couple of days that have made big headlines in the national media. One, of course, is about the struggle over the caucus sites. It kind of presented itself as another kind of union against union, partisan kind of fight behind different candidates. The other is the story that's been spreading around about possible intimidation of voters by culinary union members. Any take on either of those? And is there a danger the unions end up getting kind of smeared by virtue of their involvement in this race?
I think really it's not about union to union, union against union. It really is about the level of excitement here and the level of engagement. And of course, if you're supporting one candidate versus the other, you know, right now it's a blood sport. I really don't believe there'll be intimidation. That's not the way the unions work. They're very democratic and, yes, they want their endorsed candidate to win, but they're not about to turn their members against them. So I really think that it's all about the level of participation, the level of excitement here.
It's going to be an exciting day, and I'm glad the media are there. One caller we had this week said, you know, from some of the coverage, you would think there was only the culinary. The labor movement is much more diverse, although the culinary is an exciting and powerful union, particularly in Las Vegas. Just remind people a little bit of the sort of folks that are turning up when you have union mobilization around this election, Gail.
Oh, of course. We have nurses, and we have teachers, and we have state employees and government employees, and we have building trades are just huge here. We actually have over 225,000 union members in Nevada, and you know, culinary is a good piece of that. There's 60,000 or so, and they represent the maids and the cooks and all that. So we just have a whole cross section of life in Las Vegas engaged both in the unions and in the caucuses.
Well, and whoever it was that said this time what happens in Vegas isn't going to stay in Vegas is certainly right. You're going to be having an effect early on the national race. It really goes national after South Carolina. Finally, the labor movement. I mentioned this yesterday, but it seems to me a close study, a close lens on the labor movement in Nevada has the possibility of updating this country's image of labor in the sense that that image is still very much the white guy. The reality as seen on the picket lines, on the organizing, in the organizing meetings in Nevada is it's a service dominated labor movement we've got these days. And that means women, people of color. It's a really different face.
It really is. It's a very diverse workforce and a very divergent, you know, opinion of issues and everything that comes with that. And I think that's a slice across America as a whole.
And they're going to have a hard time putting people of color against women in this race when we're really talking about women of color a lot when it comes to the labor movement. All right. Thank you so much, Gail. I really appreciate hearing from you. I hope you get a little bit of rest maybe on Sunday. Tomorrow will be an exciting day. We'll all be watching.
Great. Thank you.
Gail Tuslow is a political consultant to the Nevada State AFL-CIO. I'm Laura Flanders. Whoopee, off to the weekend. Hasn't it been fun? I appreciate being here, sitting in for Tom. Tom will be back on Monday. I'm Laura Flanders. You're listening to Air America Radio. Don't go away. A whole lot more coming up on these stations next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.